just can't buy. But I don't care too much for money. Money can't buy me love. Can't buy me love. Thank you.
You're listening to WMFO in Medford. That's WMFO, Tufts Freeform, commercial-free, community-based radio. And you're about to listen to a subset of that community-based on WMFO, and that is Social Alternative Radio. For the next 2 hours, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. I want to thank Ear Buddies for introducing us earlier. Today, I'll be hosting. My name is Jeff, and co-host will be Diego. And we have more to talk about than we have time for, but you can probably guess some of it. The gun control movement that's happening around the country now. The women's movement. That's been active ever since Trump got elected and is deepening in some ways, and in some ways veering off to just supporting the usual suspects of the Democratic Party. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about an interview with a member of Socialist Alternative in Truthout that just came out. That's a website you may have heard of if you follow alternative progressive left media. And we'll have some musical interludes and so on. One thing that's that occurs to activists, political activists, left-wing, progressive, socialist activists, and so on, is that when you're in a period of building a movement, and there is a socialist movement out there, however underground it may seem, or however unknown it may look to you, there's a Socialist Alternative is growing in numbers. Democratic Socialist of America is growing in numbers. It's got 30,000 members on paper right now. Bernie Sanders, who called himself a socialist, you know the impact he had in the last election. Very popular demands and so on. Sanders isn't really a socialist. So we've talked about that on the show. And that's another thing that's happening right now. The word socialism is getting bandied about in some strange ways, getting watered down or being, saddled with the old red baiting from the Cold War era, which is increasing from the conservatives and the right. So, but that wasn't my point. My point was that when you're active in all sorts of protest movements and so on, because it's sort of a socialist activist rule that if you're in a period of building and there's no mass movement that is very obvious, if there's no mass workers' party like there is not in the United States, there's no big socialist, labor, communist, even green, left green. There's just no big mass workers' party in the United States. Then it's strategically important to orientate to groups that are in struggle, working people and youth that are entering into struggle. Now, Trump, of course, has, and rightly so, the Trump administration has engendered multiple struggles, concurrent struggles, struggles happening all over, regionally, locally, many you haven't heard of, we haven't heard of, some that we're involved in. And so, your resources get stretched, and you have to, you can't do everything. Unfortunately, can't be involved in all the good social justice movements that are around. And on the other hand, part of that is not just jumping from one movement to another, depending on the short attention span of the corporate media or even the elements of the progressive media. Whatever the action right in front of you is, whatever the protest right in front of you may be, is the one that will get the headlines, so to speak, and things that just started a few weeks ago or a month or two ago could get eclipsed by that, even though there's still activity happening. Now, the obvious example I'm alluding to is the women's movement that came up out of the Me Too movement and so on, and starting way back with the huge women's march after Trump got elected. These are very impressive beginnings, perhaps, to movements that will continue. But all of a sudden, because of the mass murder that happened in Parkland in Florida, the high school, The corporate media can only focus on that, and the Me Too movement, the women's movement, is forgotten. It's very important for activists, in my opinion, to not forget the previous movements, especially if they're still alive. Oh, sorry, Diego wants to say something. I don't have his mic on. There you go. Sorry,
hello?
Diego.
Okay.
You're on. This is Diego.
Well, that's like hey, how you doing?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, that's like 9/11. We were doing, there was going to be anti-globalization movement, and then 9/11 happened. Forget about the globalization.
Yeah, that. Well, I think that's a little different in the sense that that was a deliberate shift to the right by the corporate media, by the government, by all sorts of organizations, the Democratic Republican parties. They all, nobody, remember back then, nobody objected to invading Afghanistan, right? Wasn't it just like one person in Congress, Barbara Lee, I think, or
no,
somebody?
But I'm talking about like what was happening in the people, not the government.
I was getting to that. Yeah, so, no, you're right.
Prior to 9/11, there was going to be a big demonstration of anti-globalization.
Yes, there was.
And then that happened.
And it was
like you said, foreshadows everything else.
Yeah. Well, but also, though, what I'm saying right now is that, what I think the difference with now is that I don't think the government and the media and many groups are, I don't think they're deliberately targeting the women's movement to repress it. The possible women's movement or mass movement around women's issues. I don't think that's being actively repressed right now. We have found out recently Black Lives Matter has been spied on like crazy, as if it was some sort of, you know, threat. And it's not, obviously, and it's a movement bringing up, obviously.
Well, the right is saying that they're listed as a terrorist group.
Exactly, yeah, so that's what I'm talking about. Well, it's been proven that the FBI has been actively
so they're acting the same way with the Black Panthers, the way they did with the Black Panthers.
Well,
when first came
out. Again, it's a question of degrees. Black Panther movement was hit by COINTELPRO, which was a deeply invasive attack, you know, that included everything from trying to sow dissension within the ranks with fake letters and fake rumors and so on, to arresting people, a lot of people incarcerated on false charges, and also the murder of the assassination of Fred Hampton in Chicago by the police, that was probably coordinated with the FBI. There's a really good book out, just came out in the last 2 years about that, by the way, and there's that movie, The Murder of Fred Hampton, that I would urge everyone to watch. But just a little digression there. Maybe we can jump back into the main thing in a second, but talking about the women's movement that had started and is still continuing, but sort of off the radar already, eclipsed by the Parkland mass murders at the school, which we'll talk about that and gun control as well in a few minutes. But I don't know, that 911 example is a good one in the sense that, yes, that tore everyone away for that destroyed the anti-globalization movement, which was kind of, not to blame the victim, but kind of ripe for destruction in its, you know, diffuse, decentralized, sort of anarchistic, influenced manner that it approached things. And it never got beyond the protest, mass protest, mix it up with the cops paradigm, you know. And I was on one of those in Quebec, got tear gassed and all that fun stuff. And by the way, I've talked about this in the show before, the people in Quebec were amazing. They were just great. They really helped us a lot on the street, gave us water, invited us into their apartments and stuff. It was just brilliant. But despite the good intentions of many activists in that movement, and despite the good demands against the IMF and the World Bank and all that, 9/11 hit, and that showed the kind of the social weight of the movement, and that it was very, very weak. It wasn't deep into the working class. It wasn't based around, didn't have a sort of an institutional base, which could be good or bad, but you know that you do need resources, and so that rally you alluded to,
Washington
yeah, turned into nothing. Unfortunately,
I was ready to go with my friend. I was working at Irish Co-op.
Yeah.
And we were ready to go, and then 9/11 hit it. Yeah, that was it. It was like everybody just off the radar. So, yeah. You know,
really. And everything shifted to the right in a lot of other ways. Not for as long as I thought it would, but it still did. It had an impact. What we're facing right now, I think, is that just a lot of struggles breaking out all at once, and the corporate media not designed and not willing to give those struggles their time. All right. That's one reason we do our show, not the only reason, but get out some more information that's not out there. And so it does a disservice to movements that are still growing, that are still important, And so I think it's important for activists to get stuck in sometimes and not just jump in an opportunistic fashion from one movement to another. Although you do have to go where people are paying attention, where they're in struggle. I don't want to use the cliched woke thing, but, you know, where they're waking up. And that's really important, too. So it's and then you have a minimal amount of resources. And then also, you know, one thing that I think non-activists don't understand is that, you know, take, for example, the socialist movement, as small as it is or whatever, it's real people. It's workers, you know, it's students, it's youth. And all the stuff, the nasty stuff that the Trump administration is doing, that the Obama administration did before that, and that big business is doing constantly and the corporations doing constantly, that has an effect on individuals, you know. So, for example, the huge cost of school now, of college now, that just wipes out a layer of people from activism because they're spending all their time trying to raise enough money to get in the door and then stay there. And it doesn't work with a lot of people. And once you're in, you're like, you know, a lot of students, you know, try hard to stay in through, you know, certain grade level for scholarships and stuff, especially working class students that manage to get into the system. And then they feel like they don't have any time for activism. So that drops some people off. Because right now, students are in certain places, not everywhere all at once, but a lot of places they're more radicalized, more interested in socialism and so on. So, you know, it's tough. And then also every time state, local, it's not just Trump doing the cuts right now. There are state and local austerity measures, happening. We're going to get into that a little bit later, hopefully. And that has an effect on activists' ability to fight, you know, whether it's transportation problems or just having to work all the time, two jobs or whatever, if possible. You know, and I'm not using these as excuses. I'm just saying that what do you do when one movement captures the corporate media headlines or the corporate media wants to promote that movement for whatever reason, and then other movements are eclipsed and activists are not as able to sort of make them pay attention, you know? Like, for example, the Occupy movement. I remember that time I was involved in that. Social Alternative was involved in that. I remember that time very, very well. And there was this period before Occupy hit the headlines and before Occupy even started, where all you were hearing on it was a very kind of monolithic period in the corporate media, which has a certain eclecticism to it, a certain like jump from one thing to another also, like I'm just trying to describe. But they were really fixated on the Greek debt crisis and the Eurozone and saving the Euro banks and saving the whole EU project. That was like a thing in the U.S. media a lot. And this kind of stuff about Greek workers are lazy and they should accept.
Do you remember that? On, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That wasn't too long ago.
I was in, I think it was the summertime, right?
Yeah, a lot of it was the summertime.
Yeah, I remember in Cuba they would always talk about that, you know. And in Cuba they would compare Puerto Rico to be the Greek of...
Yeah,
it was just Caribbean.
Really true now, really obvious now, right?
Yeah.
Did you hear the latest on Puerto Rico, by the way? Remember Naomi Klein wrote that book, Disaster Capitalism, which I'm a little skeptical about, but I liked a lot of it. And yeah.
She's Canadian, right?
Yeah, she's Canadian, yep. And prolific author on the left, but kind of never goes all the way, never talks about the need for socialism, which drives me crazy. But points in that direction a little bit. Obviously. And so she wrote Disaster Capitalism about Katrina and so on. And then Puerto Rico, they're just following the script, unfortunately. The latest is they want to privatize, you know, all sorts of stuff there. There was already a wave of privatization there, which I think you're kind of talking about. Mm-hmm. And they're doing it more now, you know, using the hurricane as an excuse and the power not getting back. And people are still really suffering. There's a good article in the latest issue of Socialist Alternatives newspaper about that, which is also at socialistalternative.org. That's a good example of what I'm talking about. Like Puerto Rico should not be off the headlines and there should be protest movements about it. And there were initially, but you know, there's, can't protest forever. You can't be single issue. If you're going to be really a good activist, especially a good socialist. But on the other hand, if you have the resources, it's really good to try not to just jump from each thing to another, but keep grounded in movements. And there are people doing that. I know someone that went to Puerto Rico recently, not a Social Alternative, but an activist in the labor movement. And it's way after it's out of the headlines, you know, but she went and she's working down there. So to, you know, to, as you know,
well, that
to get
was a big
going,
movement I heard over there that they want in Puerto Rico independence.
Well, I was wondering about
and
that,
and they're modeling
right?
themselves yeah. with like see Cuba, they did it.
Well, I was wondering about that because like my memory of like the 80s and 90s was the Puerto Rican independence movement was a real thing, and then it died
in
down.
The 60s.
No, no, even more, in the 80s yeah. and 90s, I think. Well, okay, maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. But
well, on the 60s,
it started
more
to
like,
die down. Yeah,
you, know, you had
huge.
The Cold War. Yeah. You had a Cuba. You had this, you know, like, hey, Cuba can do it, you know. But then again, they don't understand that Cuba was also economically linked with the USSR.
Right.
And once that fell, see what, but anyway, that's another story.
Yep. And no, I agree with you.
But they do want that independent, yeah. like, yeah, you know, my own.
Maybe I'm looking at it more from the U.S. I ran into a lot of activists, let's say, in the 80s and 90s who were doing, like, prison support work for Puerto Rican activists that were in prison.
Yeah.
They were talking about independence for Puerto Rico. And then somewhere along the line, I think fairly recently, it died down. I wish I knew more about that. I don't. And what I hear is the poll swung over to not independence. But maybe if what you're saying is true, that would be great, in my opinion, because...
Well,
because
of this, the way...
Yeah, because they've been treated.
The way they were treated.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, like...
Yeah.
You know, wait a minute. You know, I thought we were part of the same, you know...
No. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, obviously, it was definitely a race thing. Or
yeah, economic and racial.
Economic,
and
racial.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And they...
So, the people that were against actually saying, I want independence, are going, I'm reconsidering.
Good.
So that's just out there now.
Glad to hear that. Anyway, so I don't know why
took a hurricane to do, you know.
Yeah, no. Well, that's there's something we talk about, like when you hear of, obviously when you're active. I don't know why I'm going into all this about activism today, but I think it's legitimate. Given all that's going on and if there's going to be a mass movement against, like, there's no mass movement against Trump right now, and we've explained why that is on previous shows, mainly because the Democratic Party does not want to have that sort of movement that could get out of its control. It believes in the system. It will even prop up Trump in order to save the system and make the system look viable, and that's been happening. There has been collaboration with the Democrats, with Trump, not on all issues, obviously the tax thing, not, but on others, yes, there has been, like on the military budget and so on. So we've talked about that.
Well,
in
let's
previous
not forget
shows.
He's also a liberal, neoliberal Trump in the 90s.
Yeah, he was Democrat. Yeah, he was a Democrat.
So
yeah. Neoliberal yeah. Democrat, which is
same,
what the Democrats
same,
are. Yeah,
same cesspool.
Yeah, absolutely. And but the point is that, like, there's all these attacks happening. They're sort of doing a shock. What is that? Shock and awe strategy was the old term. By attacking on many, many fronts all at once, cutting resources or proposing to cut resources all across the board. I mean, they're attacking the Postal Service, they're attacking the environment, the national park system, everything you can think of, food stamps, you know, you name it. So the Democratic Party is not prepared or willing or interested in a systemic critique. You know, Nancy Pelosi said, we're Democrats after all, or we're capitalists after all, to a question about similar about the system itself. So without that mass movement developing, or maybe it is developing, but without it being happening, then there's a lot of, again, going back to that thing we were talking about a few minutes ago, a lot of people that just were like, well, I don't know what to do, and also a lot of people that get depressed. A lot of single issue people that get crushed, you know, their pet issue gets smashed because they don't have the social weight, they don't have the power. And with the unions weak, with no workers' party, to develop that mass movement and develop a systemic critique and a movement against capitalism itself, we're pretty screwed. That's the working class I'm talking about, youth I'm talking about. We're just really, really hurting right now. And we would have been under Clinton as well, but it would have taken different forms, obviously. That's the way it's been going for a long time in this country. Internationally, you see fightbacks more so than here, like new left parties arising. I just was reading about one in Chile, for example, in Italy, other places, some of them small. But in the U.S., and the U.S. possibly is moving towards something like that. You can't tell. Like, it looks like by the end of this year, 2018, you know, as the elections get closer, the congressional elections, and then to 2020, presidential and congressional elections, it looks like it's just going to be a wave of lesser evil, you know, lesser evilism, a tsunami of lesser evilism, because Trump is is really rotten, and people don't see an alternative to that. They don't see a ready alternative to that, like ready made alternative to that. And all the constant brainwashing is everything within the two-party system. And that's what I was getting to with the women's movement earlier. Joanna mentioned, maybe we'll have time to get into that a little bit, that the new women's movement that's starting is unfortunately channeling a lot of the energy into the Democratic Party, losing some of their best activists as a result. But putting everything, like, you know, just run as a Democrat, get elected as a Democrat in 2018, that's going to solve nothing. And right now it actually sets back being able to build a larger movement in a lot of places in the United States, a lot of big cities, especially Democratic parties, the one party system, it's in power and it's the one cutting the schools. It's the one cutting programs. It's the one doing the austerity. It's the one not telling you to go out on the street to fight Trump. We wanted to organize a generalized anti-Trump rally in November in Worcester, Socialist Alternative. Mm-hmm. And we started checking around with all the groups that we work with, different unions, different community groups, and so on. And none of them wanted to do it. They just don't have that vision. Don't have that. They're worried about pissing off conservatives, you know, that support Trump. They don't understand. They don't put the issues together, you know. Now I have some good news about some things happening in the labor movement and so on that maybe will turn that around. But again, people looking to the Democratic Party for building a mass movement against Trump have already been and will be sorely disappointed. You know, the most you could say is if a mass movement gets going against Trump, a generalized one, Democratic Party will try to co-opt it and maybe put their brand on it. But and if they are able to do that, it will fail. It will not do what it needs to do. But and I don't just mean to single out Trump. You know, it's a Trump administration and the Republicans and so on, and a lot of the Democrats. So anyway, getting back to the main point of being stuck in, keeping, you know, not letting the corporate media determine what to pay attention to and so on. We just wanted to. You know, let the listeners know about upcoming, there is International Women's Day on March 8th. Internationally, there's calls for strike action. I don't think that will happen here. But it should dovetail in with the burgeoning Me Too and other women's rights actions and protests that have been happening here since Trump got elected. It probably won't because of what I was just talking about. The leaders of the march in Washington, both of them, there's been two now, there was one in Washington, and there was one that was in local areas. Both, the turnouts for both were phenomenal. The mood was great in terms of wanting to get out there and protest, but the leaders are tied to the Democratic Party, so they're channeling all that again into the elections, electing Democrats 2018-2020, which is not going to change anything. And by doing that, again, they take energy away from possibly building a mass movement against Trump. And they're not tying it into International Women's Day that I'm aware of in any areas in the United States. Socialist Alternative and other groups are trying to turn March 8th, International Women's Day, into a day of protest, at least. And also before that, there's protests coming up around gun control and around union rights and so on. And within that, other women's protests. I don't have all the information. And again, I'm focusing on Worcester because that's where I'm doing a lot of organizing right now. But if you want to find out what's happening with Socialist Alternative or other left groups in Boston, just go to socialistalternative.org and follow the trail to the Boston organization, or go to Facebook and look for Boston Socialist Alternative and so on. But anyway, what I'm getting at is that leading up to International Women's Day, we're having a public meeting in Worcester at Clark University Wednesday, September 28th at 7 p.m. at Jonas Clark 001. That's a building there. And the speaker, we both know, Toya Chester, who is a feminist, socialist, and labor activist. Toya is a member of the union IBW Local 103. She was also leading activist for socialist Shama Sawant's successful re-election campaign to Seattle City Council. When I was out there campaigning in Seattle for Shama Sawant, for Social Alternative candidate Shama Sawant in 2016, I think it was, Toya was working in the office there. She was a staff person. And she had tons of energy, and the days were long, as you know, with any electoral campaign. And these are mostly volunteers. And the days were long, and but she had tons of energy. She's a really good activist, speaks Spanish, etc. And now an apprentice in IBW. And anyway, she'll be...
IBW?
Oh, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Oh, okay.
And I actually have a little factoid about that I was going to talk about. This is sort of union education for any listeners that are wondering why we bother talking about unions and what they mean and so on. So that's Wednesday, February 28th, 7 p.m., Clark University, Jonas Clark, 001. And then on International Women's Day, March 8th, around 1 p.m., a meeting with Tanya Whitworth, who is a member of Social Alternative and an activist in the Graduate Employees Organization, a union of graduate students out in UMass Amherst. She'll be at Worcester State University in the this room called Wesleyan Hall. 1 p.m., March 8th, Wesleyan Hall Conference Room, Seven Hills Conference Room, it's called, Worcester State University, International Women's Day, March 8th. And basically what we're talking about there is Me Too and a new women's movement. And we're also talking about socialist feminism and the struggle, worldwide struggle, women's struggle. So it's a broad topic. Just a quick blurb from the leaflet. Me Too is the latest mass women's action in a string of events globally that points towards an explosive move against sexism and the billionaire-dominated political establishment. The mass outrage expressed in the Me Too campaign is an empowering moment for the still-brewing new women's movement. We need to move to the next step and have a self-organized women's movement fighting with disruptive tactics to win victories. As capitalism pushes workers back on so many fronts around the world, a global women's movement is emerging. And while sections of the political establishment may pay lip service to women's equality, they represent an economic system whose foundations are built on class, race, and gender exploitation, just like the world of big Hollywood movies, for example. Only a social society based on radical egalitarianism can bring an end once and for all to the reign of all the Harvey Weinsteins, etc. So, again, that's been pushed off the radar right now. It's been pushed into the... the corporate media is not talking about the Me Too movement and women's rights in general all of a sudden. That was predictable. I remember talking about that. Like, we had to postpone the first meeting we were going to have about this because of the snow. There was a snowstorm. And Worcester is notoriously, hilly and slippery and bad.
Does Worcester get worse?
Worcester. Because they don't plow enough and all that kind of stuff. And it's the second biggest city in New England, but it's very poor compared to Boston. And so anyway, we had these meetings set up, and Toya took time off from work, and so she still has a job. We were debating whether to cancel. We finally canceled. And I remember the time saying, this could be off the headlines in 2 weeks like everything else, And unfortunately it is. But that doesn't matter. You have to get stuck in. You have to do what you can to keep movements going, to try to see, test the waters, see what's going to happen. I was explaining to someone yesterday about how we won, how Socialist Alternative and Shama Sawant won that position on Seattle City Council and then got reelected again. So we have a socialist now on Seattle City Council. And I was explaining that it wasn't just a process of sitting down and mapping out a plan. You have to take a step and see how the step goes. So the first time Shama Sawant ran, she ran for a statewide representative office, ran against the most powerful statewide representative, and lost, but got 35,000 votes. And that came after the Occupy movement, which told us something, right? Like, Occupy had a lot of problems, but at least it got inequality back. That's the story I started to tell earlier. Remember that summer? Greek workers are lazy. Why won't they give up their social benefits for the Euro banks and all this stuff? And it was the most one-sided.
Kind of people I want to turn around. Won't you give up your social benefits, like your retirement and your this and your that?
Give up your high salaries.
It's fine for them, but it's not good. It's like,
yeah. I mean, right now, corporate media journalists, the lower ranks are getting paid garbage and they're in trouble. Because of
the media horse?
The corporate media horse. They're in trouble right now. The lower ranks, because of what's been happening with the print media and the internet and all that. But believe you me, the upper ranks, the ones that, the names you know, the faces you know, they're getting paid way more. They're in the 1%. And they reflect it. And that's a reason for that. It's like the, you know, it's
who's
like.
Who's that guy from CNN? I can't stand Wolf something?
Wolf Blitzer.
Yeah. Oh,
I do not consume the information from Wolf Blitzer, but I've heard about it.
He's yeah. got that look. I'm like, okay, I heard about it.
I gave up on CNN a while ago because they seem to not be putting the resources into things
even
that other,
like
other
the,
ones
the guy
do.
That Trump had a quarrel with during the.
Oh, he
Spanish
was on NPR.
Guy.
He was on NPR this morning.
Like, I can't stand
Jorge,
him either.
Jorge Ramos.
I can't stand him.
He wasn't bad, though, today. He was like...
I understand, but he's also, when it comes to talking about... he interviewed the guy who's running for Moreno Party in Mexico.
He
asked him about Cuba. do you still want
to be... Red-baiting,
do you, do you agree with this dictatorship? Do you agree with... I'm so reactionary.
Well, that's how Senor Ramos gets the big bucks. But what he had to say today... wasn't half bad, amazingly. And I'm not defending him. I'm just saying that they were pitching him softballs, but he could have hit them a different way. Like, for example, Jorge, you've been accused of advocacy journalism. What do you think? And he actually came out in favor of advocacy journalism. He said that we have a duty to report the facts, but also... And a lot of this is bullcrap, but whatever. We have a duty to report the facts, but also if there's an obvious lie, should we be pointing out Trump's racism? And I was like, yeah, you should, Jorge. Good. But, of course, that comes with, every one story where he goes out on a limb and calls out Trump, which he did at a press conference, and Trump tried to shut it down. Trump said, go back to Univision. Remember that? Go back to Univision. Yeah, Trump, you got somewhere to go to. But anyway, so it was like... I don't know. I came out of that little interview thinking, at least he made a few good points. I don't have any illusions in him, though, because you don't get into that position without
defending the system. Well, just like I said, he interviewed the guy who's running for Moreno.
That's horrible what he did.
It's basically anti-corruption, because Mexico is a mess. But he asked the guy, and the guy was like, well, I don't get involved with... I'm talking about Mexico. I'm not talking about Cuba or this and that. He kept on going on about Cuba and Cuba. I'm like, what they do in Cuba is a whole different thing than we're doing
Cuba,
here.
Cuba,
you know,
Cuba.
Cuba's. So I agree with the guy from Moreno. It was like, why is he putting Cuba in the mix when we talk about Mexico now? Yeah, the problem's here, not there. There's no, you know what I mean?
You know,
he's like, I don't know what's happening in Cuba, but we're talking about Mexico here. This is what's happening here now.
Cuba, this little island.
But he just kept on like thinking. Yeah. I'm like, you serious? So basically, he kept on talking in a way like he wanted him to like say, yeah, I agree with socialism or Cuba, which is not really socialist. But anyway.
Yeah. No, I hear you because what I immediately think of
very reactionary.
I agree. And what you're saying makes me think of like a very obvious fact that the United States has since 1959 just cannot accept that they don't control that island.
And he's part of that mouthpiece.
It's just you don't control one U.S. imperialism. Listen up, you don't control one little island, and you're going crazy. You control the rest of the hemisphere. You really do. So,
it was a grenade. It was a police action.
If U.S. imperialism was a person, you'd say, chill out, because you're just stomping on the people throughout Latin America, and you can't stand that Cuba's not, you can't stomp on Cuba? Give me a break, man.
Well, you know what it is. It's an example.
I know, exactly.
It's an example. It can be done.
Yep.
You know?
Well, it depends what it is. Defying U.S. imperialism, yes, they've done a great job. That's not, but as you said, it's not socialism, and what they really don't want, and that's why they're going after Venezuela so badly, they don't want the example of socialism, and not that Venezuela is not socialist. It's funny, though, same guy, probably Jorge Ramos or somebody at NPR
they call it socialist.
They call Venezuela socialist without qualification on national propaganda radio a lot of the time, and I just laugh at that.
No, not
that's
even. They'll
hilarious.
Say la dictadura comunista.
Really?
Straight up. Oh, when they talk about Cuba. Oh,
I'm talking about...
I'll give you the sample when he did to the guy from Moreno, the guy who's running for president under that party.
I understand, yeah.
He goes, ¿Entonces tú estás, acuerdo con el régimen comunista en Cuba? In other words, are you in agreement with the communist regime in Cuba?
Yeah.
Things like that. It just pisses me off.
Well, what would be good to...
there's no here and there. Yeah, it's like, this is Mexico today, the corruption, and you're interviewing me as a Moreno. He literally just told him right in his face. It's like, this interview's over.
Good.
he was so left, and it's like,
I'm pretty sure
stuck to his guns.
I'm pretty sure Jorge Ramos knows that Cuba is also changing even as he speaks, right? So they're allowing more businesses in and so on. In fact, if Clinton had been elected, who knows what would have happened. Cuba might have been all the way capitalist now. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but like much further along the road. I think their model is China. I really do. And that's, you know, state capitalist now. But with Trump coming in and pulling back on certain ways to get involved with Cuba by the businesses, but also people, you know, Trump's regime reinstituting rules to keep Cuba isolated. It has the unintended consequence, I think, of keeping Cuba more towards a planned economy, however messed up that is, the bureaucratic planned economy instead of the workers'
it's
democracy.
It's still keeping us
economy.
In the left, kind of, so to
yeah,
speak.
Yeah, still creating not letting imperialism rot Cuba out from within. But again, that's not from the standpoint of Cuba being socialist, but...
And they amped up the military.
Where?
Ever since Cuba. Ever since...
Oh, I didn't know that. Really?
Oh, yeah. 40,000 Russians... Back into their
back in Cuba.
They have a big Russian base.
Yeah. Oh well. But anyway, the you're right. The example of Cuba, any example where they want to label socialist but is not socialist, partially because you can't have socialism in one island or one little country, but you could have a socialist movement, obviously, and has kind of flared up from time to time, spring up in Latin America, and that scares the pants off of U.S. imperialism. So, yeah, that's true.
I mean, look at Morales. He's still in power, and they call him the dictator. They say, well, Bolivia's a communist. Yeah.
He's been elected.
Name. I can't even pronounce it.
Jorge Ramos?
Jorge Ramos.
Yeah.
Him.
Well, they
propagating
have,
all this.
Yeah. Okay, I take back what I said about he gave a good interview.
The Torura de Bolivia, Morales. I'm like, so I can't
but,
say all
yeah,
the air.
No, I know. But, you know, the thing with Latin America is there was that moment a few years ago where all these nominally socialist presidents were getting elected.
Like Lula.
Lula, who's not Correa. Socialist. Who's the guy that I think it was Uruguay that lives very simple life.
I forgot his
very
name.
Poor guy.
I know what you're talking about.
Like he didn't go to the presidential palace. He stayed in his like little house and stuff. This guy in Bolivia, like you mentioned.
Morales.
There's the guy in
Ecuador.
I'm spacing. Yeah, Ecuador. Correa. Yeah.
So he's still there.
Yeah. So, but I think they shifted to the right there. But anyway, the point is that, boy, they were panicking. U.S. imperialism was panicking with all these, like, red dots, from their point of view, appearing all over the map. And then they got some conservatives, like, voting into Costa Rica, and the tide started to turn back. And I don't know. But see, you don't organize socialism from top down anyway. So it never really caught on and never really became socialist. And Brazil's a great example of that. Lula and the Workers' Party at one time was very, very socialist.
Oh, you got a lot of also
but
now.
He came here in the 80s, and I saw him in the late 80s or early 90s at Harvard. I saw Lula come and speak, and he'd already done the turn. And he was in the United States precisely to meet with bankers, which he was doing, and the media. And he came to Harvard because Harvard's a big bastion of U.S. capitalism and imperialism. And I'm sitting there in the law school. Yeah, sure. No, I'm sorry. I'm just going to finish the story. So I'm sitting there in a law school as, at that time, very excited about Brazil's large left-wing movement, large workers' party, the PT, the labor movement there, very strong. And then Lula, I could, within 5 minutes, I knew Lula was where he's coming from. And I actually spoke at that. I actually like got some mic time.
Did you speak to him?
And I spoke at him.
Oh.
He did not deign to answer. But his cohort, one of his people, was very friendly to what I had to say and pretended to still be kind of a left. Maybe he was. Maybe there was disagreements in the Lula cabinet, so to speak. But their sole purpose for that visit was to show U.S. imperialism that they were amenable, negotiable. They weren't crazy socialists.
Yeah,
don't
send the hitman against me, please.
Yeah, that too.
Don't send the economic hitman to take
elected.
Out my country.
He gets elected. He's a lot like Chavez, although the media didn't... call him that because Chavez was a little more flamboyant and so on. But if you look at the policies of Chavez and the policies of Lula for the first two regimes that Lula was a part of, or sort of president of, they talked a lot too, Chavez and Lula. They brought in the same kind of basic social welfare improvements that did win them a base among working people, but it was still a Band-Aid, you know, still really just a little Band-Aid, and were afraid to go further. Now, in Chavez's case, he went further. He nationalized the oil companies, the state oil company. He brought that back under national control, and that was a step that I don't think Lula ever did. I don't think he nationalized any big industries in Brazil, although he should have. I could be wrong about that.
I think under him...
He might have he might have nationalized the oil in Brazil.
The biggest thing that I hear from a lot of my Brazilian friends who are leftists, they say he got us out of the debt to the United States.
Ah, really? Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Well...
The economy started going up, but now it's like.
The right wing managed to get rid of an elected official, not him, but his successor, and now he's been convicted of stuff. So he didn't build a left wing movement out of that, you know.
I'm just saying I understand,
and that sounds like a
One thing he did is get us out of the debt of the United States. That's the number one thing you need to do. Just get out of the debt of the United States.
That's a funny thing because. You can.
It's kind of like getting out of debt to your bank, your mortgage, you know?
But it's not, though. I mean, with countries, they can, people can fight well enough in a lot of countries where they've gotten the big banks off their backs, the World Bank, the IMF, the Euro banks, the United States banks. If they fight hard enough, they actually get debt forgiveness, quote unquote. I love the word forgiveness.
I say do like Cuba, expropriate.
There's ways to get around that. There's ways to carry debt and still pay as a country because, you know, you can print up money and stuff. Now, that might lead to inflation or whatever. But the point is that if you start cutting things that people need to pay big banks, that's not socialist, obviously. That's not even progressive. And that is, unfortunately, where a lot of these countries end up going. The left-wingers get elected, like in Greece, Syriza got elected. And they capitulated. We've talked about that on the show before, but Syriza had the support of the people. They had a referendum that they didn't really promote a vote for. A yes vote meant you didn't. I don't know if we yes and no. Anyway, the crux of the vote, whether it was yes or no, meant you weren't going to. The country was not going to give in to the austerity measures demanded by the Euro banks, by the Euro bank, basically Central European Bank, and. And they won that referendum. Like Syriza, without much work, because they were divided on it, the people voted for that.
Also Iceland. See what they did earlier before that.
That's different. But in Greece, they voted for this. And then within the next week, I think it was, Syriza said, we don't care what the vote was. We have to give in to the big banks. And they did, and it crushed. So what I'm getting at is that there's these moments where, like around debt and other issues, where you either go all the way... or you give up, and that crushes your movement. That's what they don't understand, because you can't organize that stuff from the top. People on the bottom, if they're suffering, and they don't see a way forward, and they don't see a vision, then your maneuvers are going to be meaningless. You know, it's just going to mean that same old to them. You know, you can use that metaphor for U.S. politics much easier with a duopoly of the Democrats and Republicans and so on. Iceland is a small country, obviously. They went after the bankers, put some in prison, which is unusual.
Oh, no, I love that.
But I'm not sure where that ended up.
In a right society, that'd be the norm.
Yeah, I know. I would be. But go into exile or something. Just leave us alone.
Hey, you see that island? That's yours.
There you go.
Yeah, plenty of vegetation. Enjoy. Just go.
So before we get into talking about the gun control movement that's building right now, I just want to connect the dots back to what we were talking about with the women's movement. Not so much the corporate media, pushing the focus elsewhere, but the women's movement itself, or again, the burgeoning women's movement, the nascent women's movement, whatever qualifier you want to put on it, channeling everything through the Democratic Party. There was a really good article by Amir Kafagi on January 23rd, 2018, marching into the arms of the Democrats. It was in Counterpunch. And I just wanted to highlight that. Please read that, listeners, if you like to read or not. But anyway, he is a really good quote from this. The leaders of the Women's March are obviously trying to use their brand to influence the upcoming midterm elections, which is happening this year. Linda Sarsour, a co-chair of the Women's March, was quoted as saying on their website, quote, "This campaign will mobilize a new group of activists to create accessible power to our voting polls," end quote. Well, and then back to the article, the power that they seem to be describing is vague and symbolic. Actually, it's downright passive and inept. Nowhere on their website do they mention any criticism of the role of the two-party system in maintaining an capitalist economic and political system that thrives from oppression and exploitation. At the very least, you won't find any mention of the devastating effects that neoliberalism has caused for millions of working-class women throughout this country, as well as in the global South. Both parties, by the way, jointly endorsed and enacted neoliberal policies happily arm in arm. Nor will you find any mention of protesting militarization or imperialism. Are these not important women's issues? And yet the most important piece missing from their entire platform is the central roles that class and race play in the oppression and exploitation of working class women. The entire notion of class is invisible to the Women's March organizers, while the centrality of race is watered down. And remember, there was that controversy at both women's marches of in certain places like Philadelphia and other places, community groups, primarily women of color, refused to participate or participated under protest, so to speak, because of the outright strategy, like actually said to them that no, they don't want to bring race, so-called racial issues or whatever, into the mainstream of the women's march rallies, you know. So, quote, for the Women's March, transformative change will come from all hands on deck support for the Democratic Party, the same party, by the way, that's responsible for rigging the Democratic primary against Sanders, same party that nominated neoliberal warmonger Clinton for president. It was the Democratic Party, it was Democrat Obama, who was responsible for the Wall Street bailouts, the deportation of more people than every previous presidency combined, and massive increase in military conflicts around the world. By the way, don't mean to start a huge digression about Jorge Ramos again, but one of the things he said today that I thought was positive, that he acknowledged that Obama... Okay, so they got into this thing about... Here comes the digression. They got into this thing about voting. Like, they had this, like, sort of racialized view, the interviewer, of voting, which is problematic, and actually the answer kind of pointed that out. What happened to Latinos with the recent election? Why didn't they just all vote for Clinton and not, therefore Trump not get in, right? As if this would solve anything. But... Jorge Ramos' answer was interesting because he had, you know, he had the numbers at his, you know, at his fingertips there, which was basically like, well, a certain number, I think it was 7 million or something, voted for Trump. So the Latino community.
7 million?
Don't quote me on the number.
Okay.
But a certain number, large number, voted for, there's like 13 or 14 million Latino voters, eligible voters. A certain number, don't quote me on the 7 million, voted for Trump. It was a high number, relatively speaking. It was a number where you'd be like, why? You know, so...
Gusanos.
So he's like basically saying, well, you know, it's kind of older established citizens not being in solidarity with the newer immigrant population. That's a factor. But yes, it does shows we're not a monolith, which is true. He could have gotten into the role of the churches. He could have done a lot of stuff that he didn't do. But I thought that was a fair point. Then he gets into a very good point, which was, well, also they weren't excited, right? What did Obama do when he was in power? He promised a lot of change. Remember he used to see, si se puede? Remember
yeah.
Obama said that?
The whole support of
and one of the first things was in immigrant rights. Yeah, well, yeah, he didn't do anything for the unions, but also he did nothing for immigrant rights. He promised immigrant reform. It never happened. And people remembered that, so then they weren't excited about the Democrats because they linked Clinton, correctly so, with the Obama administration policies. And they didn't go out to vote. So he got another figure about how many Latinos did not go out to vote. You could, by the way, switch that to any racial category you want. Mm-hmm. Many, many working class people did not go out to vote because, they're as in every election, they don't see in the Democratic Republican parties anyone even remotely speaking to their issues. I'm not defending abstention. Mm-hmm. As socialists, we like people to get used to voting, and we like to dig out where we can left-wing, you know, left independent lefts, green lefts, somebody to vote for. So we're always trying to find something to vote for, something to campaign for on the left.
Yeah, I always told people, go independent party. And Jill Stein. Yeah.
There you go.
And,
right. And we like, endorse
Jill
Stein.
Well, I'm going to vote for someone who's going to have a chance.
Well, he mentioned Stein. Well, the chances
at that point,
building the future is a chance. Do you want a future or not? But he mentioned Stein here. But I don't have much time to go through all of this article. I just again would recommend it. Marching into the Arms of the Democrats, Amir Kafagi, January 23rd, 2018, Counterpunch. Maybe one more quote from this. Community leader Megan Malachi from Philly Real Justice, a coalition of local activist groups, has stated, quote, the Philadelphia Women's March, as an example, is that once again demonstrated their disconnect from the concerns of working class black women and their families' communities. She went on to say that by coordinating the police coordinating with the police, the Women's March organizers are ignoring, quote, are ignoring local struggles against police terrorism and choosing to center the bourgeoisie aspirations of white feminism. Another tone-deaf epic fail, quote, end quote. And that happened, like I said, in other areas as well. And then he ends. I like this little quote at the end here. He goes, let's see. I won't read the whole thing. Not all women are equal, nor do they share a common struggle. Let's not forget that 53% of white women voters cast their ballot for Trump. There you go. 53% of white women voters cast their ballot for Trump. Ouch. Many, and again, I don't say that saying they should have cast their vote for Clinton instead. It's just, you know, that's not good. poor and working class people of all genders will never be liberated if we keep joining coalitions and parties with the very people who have vested interests in maintaining our oppression. It's time to wake up and see that we are being herded into the trap that has kept us poor and exploited in the first place. It's time to say time's up to the Democratic Party and time's up for the two-party system. And earlier in the article, you talked about the Democratic Party's ties to Wall Street and so on. I didn't have time to really. Okay, here we go. Working class people. I will read one more quote. Sorry. Working class people can't be expected to share the same party with the likes of Wall Street. Our interests are fundamentally in conflict and should be in opposition to Wall Street's interests. Marxist writer and thinker Joe G.K. agrees, adding that, quote, the two-party system is a system. System in big letters, big caps. That the parties operate in tandem. That the role of the Democratic Party is to be the lesser of the two evils, to move to the left when the masses begin to become radicalized so as to prevent the formation of a true People's Party. In that sense, the theory of the lesser of two evils is the greatest evil. And yet the Women's March is mute when it comes to supporting information of a third party, et cetera. He goes more into that. So that's a really good article. And it cuts to what we were talking about earlier, that, you know, you have these movements and record numbers of, I think it was declared the largest demonstration in U.S. history, right? The Women's March after Trump got elected. Then you have in the local cities, which was largely ignored in the corporate media, by the way, in a national basis, but the huge turnouts in local cities on the second round of the Women's Marches that happened recently. And then you had the Me Too stuff getting a lot of media attention and happening and protests happening around that. And education happening around that, and then all of a sudden, it's disappearing, right? And we're trying not to let it disappear in our small way. We hope it won't disappear. But part of the reason it is disappearing, and this would be completely counterintuitive for some of the leaders of the movement, because they just keep channeling everything in the Democratic Party and refuse to build a mass movement. It's sort of like what Sanders is doing. Sanders comes out with like a pronouncement, I'm all for Medicare for all. That's great. And Sanders is very good at tapping into issues and demands that matter to a lot of working class people of all, you know, races and gender and so on, all genders or whatever. And he does a good job at that sometimes. But you got to look at the timing. You got to look at the context. He declares the Medicare for all thing when there's no mass movement happening for it. And there isn't even any little movement happening for it, really. There's just a constant, of course, good information and education and propaganda in a good sense from people that fight for that issue all the time. But he says that at a time when there's more people are focusing on other issues around Trump, and more to the point, I mean, he can't control a lot of that stuff, but more to the point, he doesn't try to use his own position to build the mass movement. You understand? He's using his position now to reform the Democratic Party, quote unquote, reform the irreformable, and in reality. So he's just putting all his effort into that consciously and not trying to do a mass movement around something he says he believes in, right? Because he's part of the Democratic Party, although he's declared independent, he's part of the Democratic Party and apparatus, and he won't go out and risk a movement that can't get channeled back into the Democratic Party, a movement that might get radicalized, a movement that might get to other issues, you know? Like, Sanders is very weak on, like, imperialist issues and anti-war issues and stuff like that. And if you fight seriously for universal health care, Medicare for all, Medicaid for all, blah, 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 you fight for those incredibly important, necessary issues, believe me, the military budget's going to come up. It's going to be a big deal. Why is all this money going to the military? You can take a fraction of that money and give health care for all, you know? Anyway, so I think the point is made. Hey, before we get into the gun control stuff, maybe we'll take a break. Before that, we will... sorry about that. Left my phone on. We'll take a break, hear some music, and then come back with the second half of the show. You're listening to WMFO in Medford. That's Tufts Freeform Radio. And there's that phone again. Sorry about that. And we'll be right back.
Shot down there, the cocaine guns jammed downtown, the killing clowns, the blood money men, shooting foes. Washington bullets again, as every cell in Chile will tell, the cries of the tortured men. Remember Allende and the days before, before the army came. Please remember Victor Jara in the Santiago Stadium, es verdad. Again, and in the Bay of Pigs in 1961, Havana for the Playboy in the Cuban sun. For Castro is the color is a redder than red. Those Washington bullets want Castro dead. For Castro is the color. The bullet is a spray of lead. America.
rebel that the Moscow bullets missed. Ask him what he thinks of voting communist. Ask the Dalai Lama in the hills of Tibet. How many monks did the Chinese get in a war?